talks like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animal, talking animal, talking animal. Walks like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animals, talking animals.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss, and my guest today is Ted Leo, the singer-songwriter, multi-instrumentalist, frontman of Ted Leo and the Pharmacist, which is set to perform a series of concerts in June to celebrate the 15th anniversary of their critically acclaimed album, Hearts of Oak. A few years ago, he teamed with Amy Mann, creating a new band, The Both. More recently, he released his first solo record, The Hanged Man, which generated glowing reviews. Leo's a longtime vegan who, some years ago, appeared in promo spots for PETA on that topic, and over the years has discussed his views on going vegan and veganism. With any luck, we'll address those topics, plus music, activism, comedy, those June concerts, and more. I'm going to speak with Ted Leo in a few moments here on Talking Animals. Also later in the show, I'll speak with Lori Letzring, manager at the Hillsborough County Pet Resources Center, where upwards of 300 cats have landed in the last few days after being seized from Fur and Feather Farm in Plant City. Needless to say, this is a crisis situation. The Pet Resources Center needs help, and we'll ask Letzring to guide us on how best we can offer that help. Also, I want to quickly mention that 3 weeks from today, May 30th, we kick off WMNF Summer Fun Drive. I'll be asking you to support Talking Animals that morning. But hell, I'm asking you to support Talking Animals now. It's hugely helpful to get early pledges, so please consider heading to WMNF.org, finding Talking Animals on the schedule, and then donating today, if you could, to Talking Animals tip jar, just to give us a bit of a running start. Hugely helpful. Right now, though, let's get to Ted with the reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj at wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. This is Ted Leo on Talking Animals. Good morning, Ted.
Good morning, Duncan. How are you?
Good. Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals this morning.
My pleasure.
So, in various places over the years, you've discussed going vegan and various aspects of veganism, topics I hope we'll address here shortly. But it's somewhat less clear to me where animals figure into the story. What sort of role did animals play, for example, in your life when you were a kid?
It's interesting. I mean, animals did not play a huge role in my life when I was a kid. I never really had pets. I think, though, what I will say about that is that that's partially because I always had a pretty healthy respect for animals. I think part of the reason I never really had pets is that, frankly, like, I didn't feel great about the idea of having them. I didn't think I could give them the kind of care that they needed. I think even as a kid, I had this sense of like, that's a little bit of a responsibility that I'm probably not up to, and I don't feel great about, you know, like these hamsters being in a cage or something.
Oh, wow. So intuitively, even apart from like, hey, how well can I care for these animals, but like, hey, I'm not even sure I go for the idea of having them in the house or especially in the cage to begin with.
Yeah, I think I did feel that. When I was in my, not when I was like 19 or something, my parents got a dog for the first time. I should also say that, my father, I think, was highly allergic to a lot of animals, so that's probably also why we didn't have them. But they got a dog. I was already out of the house. I wasn't really living at home. But I really got close to this dog that they got. It brought out a deep connection with, honestly, all animals for me. I have a cat now, but that's kind of just because she showed up at our doorstep and needed care.
All right. Well, she went to the right place, apparently. That's good.
Yeah. Yeah. But by the time my parents got that dog, I was already vegetarian. And then, a few years later, I went I went vegan, and that certainly did have a lot to do with the idea of animal welfare. But it was you know, it was part of what in the 80s and early 90s, or this was still the 80s, but you know, was a trend in the, you know, in the political punk world toward just to, you know, trying to take those steps to lead a more compassionate life.
Right. So it sounds like really the dog notwithstanding that your parents got there when you were 19, that the path really had a lot more to do with other economic and environmental, other sorts of factors, and just sort of more of a philosophical bent than direct animal thing, just because, again, you didn't have a huge history with animals directly.
Well, I would, you know, it's true that I didn't have a huge history with animals directly, but I would put, but I wouldn't remove them from the equation. I mean, the, okay. Like, you know, yeah. The decision to go vegetarian when I was 18 in 1988, it very much was rooted in animal suffering, you know, and what I, you know, what I was learning about it, even though I really didn't have a ton of direct contact with animals. You know, like, that was kind of a city.
Right. So I guess that's what I meant, in a sense that it was kind of more thinking, reading, philosophical aspect or underpinning to it than a lot of people that have a similar tale to tell do grow up with animals, and that kind of helped shape them, as well as some of the thinking and reading that went on to lead you to toward your path.
Right. Yeah. In that case, I would agree with you.
So that was some time ago. So vegetarian in 88, and then I think vegan sometime a few years after that, as I recall.
About 10 years later, like 88.
Yeah. I know that on that spot that you did do, I think I alluded to, for PETA, sort of tongue-in-cheek, I think you said there that you based your tour, at least in part, when routing, around places they like to eat. So that seems like as good a mode as any. But in all seriousness, I mean, touring for, I guess, a quarter century or thereabouts, you have developed a pretty keen awareness of sort of the primo vegan restaurants in numerous cities. So does that play some role? And when you're saying, okay, I'm going to go out and do some dates, these cities I know are great for a guy like me, and hey, these over here are maybe not so great. So does that kind of really help develop the itinerary?
It never keeps me away from a place that I feel, you know, I should be playing, but it certainly sweetens the deal.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
When I'm looking at, you know, when I'm mapping out an itinerary and you know, it lands somewhere near a place where I know there's a great place to eat, I get a little, you know, get a little kick in my step about.
Sure. Well, because that's the thing, because, you know, Florida gets a bad rap in various ways, sometimes deservedly so. But I've noticed that you speak very favorably, and have over the years, about Florida in various ways, including that there's usually some of your favorite eateries are at one place or another in Florida, whether it's South Florida or Orlando, I think, or a couple other places.
Yeah, sure. Florida's, I mean, I actually really do love Florida. I spent a lot of time off and on in some of the more, you know, desolate, not so desolate anymore, but you know, the less touristy, like, you know, Southwest coast places, just to kind of, like, you know, decouple from my manic northeastern life, and get a few minutes of reconnecting with some actual nature. But there's, you know, like, you know, you may, I'm sure you remember Sublime and Fort Lauderdale, and that place Darbar that off the coast a little bit from there. And there are a number of places in Orlando that I really like. I'm not remembering the names right now, but I know there's a newish place kind of on the southeastern side of downtown.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So with that in mind, it seems, unless I missed some dates or a leg of a tour or whatever, seems like, on the other hand, it's been a while since you've actually toured through these parts. So I don't know what we can do to lure you back down here for shows, especially if you've got great places to eat. But
yeah, it's tough. The last time I was through was with Amy in the Both, as you mentioned before. We played a few shows as part of the Tedeschi Trucks, like, sort of rolling festival.
Oh, okay.
That they do.
Yeah.
We played, in Boca and somewhere else. I'm not remembering right now, but that was a solid 2 or 3 years ago at this point.
Yeah.
It has been a while.
And I think a good deal longer since we've had Ted Leo and the Pharmacist dates in these parts.
Yeah, I think you're right about that.
All right. So
when you're driving, when you're driving, it's a little bit of a commitment, you know, to,
right.
especially if you're going to go all the way down to Miami or something.
Yeah.
But, you know, we'll get back.
Yeah, no, I'm sure. I mean, you see so many itineraries and they just sort of stop at Atlanta. And I understand the logistics and just the practicality, depending on how many other dates people can get in Florida or want to do in Florida to make it worthwhile. So I'm just trying to put the squeeze on you a little bit, Ted. That's all.
So. I hear you.
Okay.
I was actually through. You know what? I'm gonna push back because I'm remembering. I came through solo in 2016, right after the election, which was a weird time to be on tour. But I played in both Gainesville and Orlando.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. Well, as a guy who actually lives in South Florida, I guess I missed out on that because I don't think I recalled
right.
that. But okay. Successful okay, pushing
fine.
Back.
You win. Fine.
No,
fine.
No. No, I think you win in this case. But so let me let folks know this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you just tuned in, my guest is singer-songwriter, rocker extraordinaire, Ted Leo, whose latest album is The Hanged Man. While in June, he and his longtime band, The Pharmacist, will perform a series of shows to celebrate the 15th anniversary of their critically acclaimed album, Hearts of Oak. If you'd like to ask Ted a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663. Email dj@wmnf.org or text 813-433-0885. So in September of last year, when you put out The Hanged Man, it had been about 7 years or so, I think, since your last album, though during that time, again, you teamed with Amy for the both and put out the album and then did the dates. But there was a major story around this time of The Hanged Man release in Stereo Gum, which really documented in often meticulous detail what the significant struggles you'd been contending with between Ted Leo Records and I guess well before in some instances. You spoke really extensively and really candidly with the writer of that piece. So I'm wondering how you felt about the piece when it hit, when it was published.
I spoke pretty candidly about a lot of things that in the moment seemed like it was time to begin talking about. Since then, I have settled into being comfortable continuing to talk about those things, but I will be honest with you, the moment that I first saw the piece hit, I had a complete freak out.
Like sort of buyer's remorse in terms of just how candid you were?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it required some conversations with other people in my life, family members and things who I warned them that I was going to be talking about some personal things that might, you know, be surprising to hear. But still, you know, knowing that something is going to be surprising doesn't mean you're not going to be surprised by it. You know?
Right, right.
So, September was a heavy month last year. But ultimately, I think that getting a lot of that stuff out was the right move. And, you know, I hope that, you know, I just to be explicit, trigger warning for some of your audience, you know, if needed, I talked about being sexually abused as a child, not by any family members, because I mentioned my family earlier, but and it was it was something that needed to be discussed that wasn't really discussed. And I think clearing the air has ultimately been good, and I hope that it
Yeah.
People out there as well.
Well, and that was obviously, I think, probably the most powerful part of that. But just for listeners who may not have read the story, if it's okay with you, I might mention just a few other important aspects of that piece, because I think also in there you talk about that you and your wife experienced a late-term miscarriage, losing your daughter, and then separately your wife became pretty seriously ill. Development that had significant medical and emotional and financial implications, and you parted ways with your record company, in part, it seemed at least, because they were kind of aggrieved by your work with Amy Mann and the Both, I guess maybe because it was for another record label. Anyway, I mean, that's not even everything, but that's a lot. And as a longtime fan of yours, I mean, I was crushed sort of reading it just because I thought, Jesus, how is this guy still standing, much less still rocking? So I guess be curious to know to what extent, even though there was that immediate sort of fallout where you had warned people, but they still maybe weren't fully prepared. But subsequently, I mean, was it freeing in some sort of profound way? I mean, first of all, are you glad you had that kind of the scope of that kind of conversation in a publication, an article like that?
First of all, thank you for saying that, because, you know, as you're living through these, you know, as you're living through your life, sometimes, you, not sometimes, almost all the time, you don't really have the perspective to look back on, you know, the preponderance of, you know, you're just sort of dealing with things as they come, because you have to, and that really, seeing the preponderance of these things building up, and, you know, how they are, you know, collectively weighing on you and whatnot. So anyway, thanks for acknowledging that. But as far as talking about it goes, sometimes you just have to dive in and accept that you can't control how people are going to react. You can't control, you have to give other people the, you know, the dignity of their own response to certain things. But, the people closest to me, who I had to have some of the longest and deepest conversations about all of this with, were very, ultimately very kind and very open and very understanding. And I think we're all in a much better place understanding each other and, you know, what the last 40 years of our lives have been in terms of having this sort of looming in the background.
Yeah. Well, also, too, in the wake of a very deep dive piece like the Stereo Gum article was, particularly with a number of deeply personal revelations, sometimes the subject of the piece learns as much as the readers do, just along the way. Did the Stereo Gum piece work that way for you?
Absolutely. I mean, to be able to speak about it, I will say that I was already starting, you know, I was already starting to process some of this stuff over the last, you know, couple of years in ways that, I hadn't been previously. But taking that, you know, making that proactive step to actually be public about this and deal with the fallout and be comfortable stepping into a place that was going to be indefinitely uncomfortable really did help me continue to process it and figure a lot of things out. I mean, honestly, like, I think I know so much more about myself, my own behaviors, my own patterns, my own ways of reacting to things and you know, modes of thought talking about that in this one article.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, that's the thing, because, I mean, you obviously had multiple conversations with the writer and email exchanges and other kinds of things. So clearly saying, okay, we'll see what happens, but I'm ready. I'm jumping off the cliff, and short of a Wile E. Coyote or whatever, I can't unjump. Right. So you obviously, on some level, were really ready to do it, even if it was probably super scary.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. So this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest is singer, songwriter, guitarist Ted Leo, whose most recent album is The Hanged Man. We invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. So the Stereo Gum piece is out, and the Hanged Man album is out, the product of a Kickstarter campaign. And as I recall, initially at least, I think you were sort of dragging your heels about getting into the whole crowdfunding world. Do I recall that correctly? And if so, how come?
I wouldn't characterize it as dragging my heels, because that implies that, you know, I was just slow about getting to something that...
Well, just, I guess more that you were mixed about it. Yeah. But just, yeah, you seemed uneasy exactly right, about it, I guess. Yeah.
I was, yeah, certainly. I mean, look, I definitely had an evolution with this idea. When the crowdfunding model first rose as an option, let's say, I don't know, six, years ago, something like that. It did feel, you know, it felt fair. It felt like a workaround. Here's what it felt like. It felt like a cul-de-sac that was not an actual solution to the problems in the music industry.
Mm.
And it felt like, for me, you know, someone who's been doing this, working with the old model and but working with the old model, with a variation of the old model, you know, where the profit motive is, of course, there. Of course, everybody has their, you know, their bottom line. Every
sure.
punk label has its bottom line, but the profit motive is not the main driver of what we do. You know,
making yeah.
art and getting it to the people is the main motivation for what we do. And being quite generous, you know, within this capitalist system that we did not set up, but under which we must work, you know, the shift to crowdfunding initially felt like something that it was something I was very uncomfortable with.
Yeah,
it felt a little bit like, are you kidding me? After, you know, 25 years doing this or whatever, that, you know, I have to go hat in hand to get people to just pony up for a record, you know?
Yeah.
What I did realize, though, eventually, and this you know, this came through the model itself kind of growing into itself, and conversations with people who actually worked at Kickstarter, what I gradually realized is that you know, you can look at it that way, but you can also look at it other ways. It's a way, or can be a way, to simply get people involved in your project earlier in the project.
Yeah.
It's as simple as that. And once I started thinking of it in that way, it actually became kind of an exciting challenge. And ultimately, what I was able to do with it was to make a record that, you know, that I would not have been able to get the budget to make the record that I made from any record label on the planet. So, in a way, it beat the old model by a country mile.
Yeah, and it does seem like all kinds of artists, I think, including some who really sort of had to fight through the same feelings you did, have really embraced it. I mean, early on with crowdfunding, and even now, I still find situations where I think, okay, really? Like, one that came to mind a few years back was when Zach Braff crowdfunded for his movie After Garden State, and he had this big wad of dough from Scrubs. I thought, really? You gotta crowdfund your next movie? So I don't think that's who crowdfunding is for, but it does seem like it's for artists, and especially with, like you said, the seismic shifts in the music biz, in terms of making records and how the whole structure works and how the financing works and everything else. It just seems like it's very well suited, and it seems like you ended up, like you say, with a really good record that I think you're really happy with.
Yeah, you're right. And, you know, I would suggest, if there are any label people listening to this, that, you know, here's the downside of it, is that, like, I don't actually want to run my own record label, but I have to. And, you know, I'm not even... The thing was funded a year ago, and I'm not done sending everything out to everybody yet.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I'm just going to put this out there, too. That's not that crazy. Sometimes it takes a year or more to get a record out, you know, for anybody.
But, sure.
But the fact is, like, I'm essentially running my own record label, which is not something I really want to do. I have to admit, at this point, I would like to just be getting on with the business of making and playing music.
For sure.
But, you know, but here's the thing, like, why can't, you know, labels are relying more and more on, you know, what they're just calling pre-sales these days anyway. You know, I don't know if you may have noticed that so many records that come out right now, they're like, order now and you get a t-shirt and a tote bag, you know, and it comes out in 6 months or whatever. I mean, there's no reason that labels themselves can't use this same kind of platform. I found with my audience, with my core audience, that, you know, it was really engaging, and we had conversations about it, and, you know, it built enthusiasm both within them and within myself. And I think that labels could actually take advantage of this to the benefit of everybody involved as well.
For sure. And also, too, that I guess in part because of the budget that you did have or did develop through this for Hangman, I mean, it's a really good record. And did the reaction to it, and I mean, just your own feelings about it, obviously you're paramount, but did the reaction to it feel like vindication? Like, wow, I sort of wasn't so sure about crowdfunding, but look at the record I made. Look at the response that it's generating. This is a good thing.
That's really a huge thing. I mean, after so many years, not knowing where I was at career wise, what was going on with the band, I had problems with my label, as you mentioned, and not knowing, that was another thing about jumping into the crowdfunding thing, was it was a bit of like an emotional risk, not knowing how this was going to land. But it was really vindicating, and I remember walking from my little home studio that I built to the bathroom in my house, but having just realized that that the thing funded, and I just felt this huge like weight that I didn't even know I was carrying dissipate, off my shoulders, and I just had this realization that like oh wow, now I can just make art.
Yeah.
Wow.
Right. I could get back to what I do. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, but even for all the years previous that I've been doing it, I've never felt so free to just like make something. And interestingly, the songs that I completed for the album post funding of the Kickstarter, I think are the most interesting and ambitious songs on the album.
Can you say what some of those are that are in that category?
Yeah, sure. Well, the three that come to mind are actually kind of the longest and weirdest, which would be Let's Stay on the Moon, William Weld in the 21st Century, and Grey Havens.
Wow, yeah. So you just felt like, hey, now I can kind of really just do what I want. I've got the dough in hand. I can make this record, and I'm just going to finish this off in exactly the way I want.
Yeah, it makes you wonder how many seatbelts we don't know we're strapped into that we don't actually need to be strapped into.
Well, and two, that once the actual record was out, I mean, it got glowing reviews and airplay on all kinds of stations, including this one. Our music director here put it in his top 10 of the list. So it just seems like, it just all kind of rolled along. Once you said you had that last bit of funding in hand, it just seems like it's all just been super forward and positive ever since. So that's great.
Yeah, definitely. And I was able to put, here's another thing is most of the money went into the record, but it also gave me a little cushion with which I could put together a bigger band to render this stuff live in ways that I haven't been able to before. And that's been such a joy. I'm sorry to dangle that out there, not coming to South Florida right now, but I promise you we will get there.
Yeah. Well, before we're done, I'm hoping to have something in writing about coming to Florida from you.
Okay.
So, all right. Well, I want to ask about those anniversary shows, but we've got one caller that's been holding for quite some time. So I'd like to get them.
Oh, sure.
Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Ted Leo. Thanks for holding so long. Hello, it's you. Hello. I hear you clicking there. All right, shoot, I'm sorry after all this time, we're not going to speak to you. Hi, one more shot, comment or question for Ted. Okay, too bad. All right, shoot. Well, maybe they'll call back. So let's talk a little bit about the Hearts of Oak anniversary shows. So I guess sort of the basic idea behind them, but also the format, the sort of two-night format and everything. What that just seems really like a cool way to mark this momentous record.
Yeah, it snuck up on me that it's been 15 years since Hearts of Oak. Which is also, it's kind of crazy. I remember very vividly pulling into Orlando to play a show on the night that that the Iraq War started. And all of my memories of the Hearts of Oak record are tied up in that time. And, a lot of the stuff on that record is, for better or for worse, mostly worse. Still very relevant, and we've never stopped playing a lot of it.
Mm-hmm.
But it just felt like we're still technically touring on this new record, which I don't want to give short shrift to, and that's part of the reason for the two night idea.
Yeah.
But thinking about all of this time and all that has happened and not happen. Since that record came out, it just got me thinking about the entire arc of you know, this band per se and or as such, and the fact that it's really been like 20 years since I started playing under my own name in, you know, either solo or with the Pharmacist as a band of some kind. And you know, I think, as I mentioned before, you know, I have this bigger group right now that I'm so loving playing with, and it just presented an opportunity to revisit it all, and you know, maybe bring some older stuff out that we either stopped playing because the instrumentation wasn't right, or because, you know, we were, you know, you keep adding songs, you have to keep dropping songs.
Right. There's only so much space.
It's just the way it goes. So, deciding to, we're also, you know, and here's another thing is we're trying to figure out more economical and humane ways for us to tour, you know, as we're all aging, and needing to, you know, not be subsisting on Fritos and beer and sleeping on floors.
Yeah.
Next to litter boxes forever. So, you know, doing the two nights, in slightly smaller venues than we might play, where we're doing just one night. It just seems like a really fun thing to do, you know, pack it in and really, go through a survey of the whole last 20 years.
For sure. And we should note that at tedleo.com, you can find out the dates, and some people listening may be listening where they're actually handy for the dates, and some people might say, hey, time to plan a road trip. So, And let me just read an email that came in a few minutes ago while you were talking, Ted. It says, great guest, great interview. I can't imagine the life of an independent musician navigating a constantly changing music industry. Although hard, it's awesome that he has taken charge of his artistry. Thanks for your music and public service. So that's cool. And again, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss, and I'm speaking with singer-songwriter Ted Leo. We're in our final few minutes here, but we invite you to join the conversation if you'd like by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. So I think of you first and foremost as a singer-songwriter who rocks hard and rocks smart, but I also think of you as a real comedy aficionado and sometimes a comedy practitioner in one way or another. So you've long demonstrated that you're way more into comedy than just a guy who loves it. So what first attracted you to it, and at what point did you say, hey, I'd like to bring my music or whatever I can into some sort of comedy things when possible?
Well, you know, I have always been into comedy. I mean, I think since I was a child, I was buying comedy records, you know, in the 70s, and 80s. But bringing, you know, kind of, you know, getting involved in that world, and especially with my music as the often, you know, token musical guest on various comedy shows, that actually came from the other side of the equation, I would say, in the early 2000s. As we know, you know, comedians are also humans, and they apparently listen to music in the same way that, you know, us musicians listen to comedy.
Right.
And, I had a few comedians. David Cross, in particular, was one of the first people who approached me about playing on one of his shows. Mm. He was doing a weekly show in New York called Tinkle with John Benjamin, and he invited me down to play on one of his shows. And then, you know, through those connections, and also through people like Tom Sharpling, who did a show on WFMU.
Sure.
I met, you know, lots of other people with whom, you know, I already had a mutual appreciation that we didn't know. Paul F. Tompkins, Benjamin, Patton Oswalt, and then, you know, the growing New York, you know, for a while in the aughts, the New York comedy scene was really exciting. Nikki Glaser and Sarah Schaefer and Wyatt Cenac, Bronholer, you know, yeah, all these people were doing great stuff, and I just fell in with them. And I had actually I had stopped playing solo very much at that point in time. Mm. Falling in with all these comedy people kind of got me back into into doing a lot of solo stuff. First of all, because that was the easiest way to, you know, to jump on a bill and play
sure.
a couple of songs. But also, you know, I remembered how to say yes to things from them.
Mm.
I remember in particular having a conversation with Kurt Braunholer where I played on a show with him. And it was just like, so what are you doing later? And he's like, oh, I got another 10 minutes to do at this other thing, and then I'm going to another thing to do another 10. And I was like, wow, oh, yeah, because you can just jump on the subway or in a cab. You know, you don't have to bring a guitar. You know, you can
right.
get up on stage and do your thing. And I started, like, you know, thinking about how I could do a similar thing in my life, you know, how I could do these kind of, how I could just say yes to more things and make it work. That was a really fun and heady time.
Yeah. Well, speaking of Paul F. Tompkins, I remember years ago that music video for Bottled in Cork, and he had this sort of
right.
grand, almost operatic role in that. And then I think for a while you were doing the Julie Klausner's show podcast, whatever, How Was Your Week? And I guess I didn't realize the history with David Cross, but you're part of, or at least have been, a part of the Comedy Resistance, this sort of touring collective that aims to boost political activism and stimulate voter registration. And he just did that in Austin at the Moon Tower Comedy Festival, which, again, David Cross was hosting and performing on. So
that's right.
That's all kind of old home week. Yeah. So very cool.
Yeah. And it was, you know, interestingly, it was also, of course, thank you for mentioning Julie. I can't believe I forgot her. I was the musical director for her show for a while, which was really, really fun. And it was through, it was actually through these comedy connections that I met Amy Mann, because she's the L.A. equivalent.
Yeah, you know, she's sort of the Largo
in New York,
the Largo wing of that. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Very cool. So let's see. I think we do have one more caller that I think wants to get in on this. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Ted Leo. We're in our final moment or two. Hello. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Ted Leo. Okay, well, starting to think we're in a bad movie here, but anyway, so we are in our final moments, Ted, but I might in some ways bring it back to sort of how we began, because if I'm not mistaken, when you're home, I think I read a couple different places or heard a couple of different places that you really love to cook, like in part, I guess, to offset the relentless pattern of eating out that's just kind of a given when you're touring. So are you still a big cooking guy when you are at home?
Yeah, I think that, you know, I would say 6 out of 7 nights, we eat at home.
Okay. And what are your favorite dishes to make?
Well, you know, favorite dishes to make. I mean, favorite dishes to make are not necessarily the most healthy or interesting.
Okay. Well, you can answer it any way you like. We're wide open. Yeah.
More on the comfort side of things, but, you know, I am half Italian, and there are some different ways of cooking pasta that I have become enamored of. Like you can do smaller shapes in a risotto style, where you're kind of like slowly adding water and wine if you do that, and, you know, other things. And you know, this time of year when we start getting ramps up here, I like to do like a penne risotto style with like porcini mushrooms and ramps is a really
nice
great dish. Yeah.
Well, I'd like to see a Ted Leo cookbook with contributions and commentary from friends who are musicians and comics, and I'd buy that book. So
that's not a bad idea. Wow.
All right. Well,
get on that.
Okay, cool. I'll look forward to it. But all right, so Ted, I think we are sort of in the home stretch. We've been speaking with Ted Leo. Again, the latest record is The Hanged Man. You can go to tedleo.com and check out the dates for the 15th anniversary celebration shows for Hearts of Oak, and maybe hit the road. And do you anticipate at all announcing any additional dates of those shows, or those are pretty much it for the time being?
I think those are pretty much it for right now.
Okay.
You know, unfortunately, I have to be honest with you, like, the economics of it is such that, you know, this is what we're limited to right now. But throughout the rest of the year, I'll definitely be doing more touring.
Cool.
And at the very least, I'm sure I will get down there in some form.
Just to get me to stop whining, probably, if nothing else. Yeah. So.
Well, it might be your whining that actually does the trick.
Okay, well, good. I'll take full credit for it then. Awesome. Okay, Ted, well, thank you so much for making the time to join us today on Talking Animals. Really enjoyed speaking with you. Thanks again.
Thank you very much, Duncan.
All right, thanks. In a few moments, I'll speak with Lori Letzring of the Hillsborough County Pet Resources Center, which has been inundated by cats after around 300 were seized amidst horrific conditions at Fur and Feather Farm in Plant City. It's a dire situation. Of course, the Pet Resources Center was already loaded with cats because this is kitten season before all this happened. So we'll hear how we can help right now, though. It's time to step into the Comedy Corner with a nod to part of our conversation with Ted Leo. This is a piece by Chris Porter called Vegan Date on Talking Animals.
Girl, she's gorgeous, smart, but she's a vegan, so that's over before it started. What do you say to a vegan on a date other than, hey, stop crying, I'm trying to eat? I got nothing against you vegans. God bless you if you're here. You don't eat meat, you don't wear animals. That's fine, that's your prerogative. I'm just saying, stop looking at me like I'm an asshole. Because we were here first. There were no vegans 40 years ago. You know why? They all died in January. That's why. But now when I'm eating my steak, don't boo and hiss at me, because we are not the only species that eats meat. When you see tigers attack a gazelle, you don't see a bunch of hippie tigers off to the side like, boo! Boo! Can't believe I'm wearing this. Boo! No, they're eating the meat. You know why? Because meat's delicious, that's why. I'd eat more vegetables, but they taste like they came out of the ground.
That was Chris Porter with a piece called Vegan Date, taken from his album Ugly and Angry. Okay, on to Lori Letzring of the Hillsborough County Pet Resources Center. To fill us in on this whole seizing all the cats and overloaded at the resource center. This is Lori Letzring on Talking Animals. Good morning, Lori.
Good morning, Duncan. Thank you for having us.
Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals. So talk a little bit about the circumstance behind seizing all those animals in Plant City.
Sure. So last Thursday, May 3rd, we executed a warrant to take animals in distress from Fur and Feather Farm, Inc. That's out on Bruton Road. At the time, we confiscated several hundred animals. In fact, the total has now come to 327 cats. There were five dogs, and there were birds on site that were actually assessed on site by another agency. We were made aware that there was an issue out at this rescue when a veterinary clinic here in our area contacted us. Some cats that were owned by Fur and Feather Farm were brought into this veterinary clinic, and they were in very poor shape. So the veterinary clinic was concerned that there was more that they hadn't seen, and they contacted us and made us aware, and we investigated promptly. So then that led to the search warrant and taking custody of all of these cats.
So what is the total cats that were seized and brought over to the Hillsborough County Pet Resources Center?
Sure. There were 327 cats taken over the two-day period of Thursday and Friday.
Mm-hmm.
There were six cats that had to be euthanized due to them being in very poor shape.
Yeah.
We have a number of very sick cats that our veterinary team are also attending to now. We're seeing a lot of upper respiratory infections, parasites, fleas, emaciated cats, dehydrated. You can imagine. They were living in kind of a colony situation, and not all of them were getting care, and not all of them were necessarily getting fed at the community areas where they were putting the food out.
It's a tough situation, would be with that number anytime, but as I mentioned before introducing you, we're also at the time of the year where I'm sure the shelter is already tapped out just because it's kitten season and things usually load up with cats anyway. So do you kind of feel like you're in a bit of a crisis situation with just the gigantic number of cats that are there to begin with and then there since all these were seized?
Yes, we really do, Duncan. We are in a bind because we have cats, literally on top of other cats. We do get a lot of kittens in. We started getting kittens late last month, and we are in a bit of a predicament. We're hoping, frankly, that the owner of these cats will sign them over to us, will do the right thing by these cats, so that we can then begin to, those that are healthy and in good condition, we can go ahead and begin to adopt out. That would be the best scenario for everyone. As you know, cats have a tendency, when they're stressed, to have their immune system not at its peak. And so our concern is, the longer that we have to keep these cats here, you know, obviously it's a stressful situation, you know, we don't want them getting sicker.
Of course. How can people help? I mean, I know there is a Amazon wish list for things that the center could use, and I posted that in the comments of three different Facebook posts that I made this morning, a Talking Animals radio show, WMNF bulletin board, and my own personal Facebook page. So there's a link there that people can click on and see some things that would be extremely helpful if they could, if they feel like spending a couple bucks to help the situation. But what else? I mean, I assume any kind of fostering or, needless to say, adopting would be gigantically helpful.
Sure, and let me first just say thank you so much for putting out the word. That's, you know, that's the biggest part of this, is letting the community know that there's a need, and the community responds. I mean, I will tell you right now, we have been getting a lot of donations, and that's been tremendously helpful, since, as you can imagine, we don't have the facilities to house all of these cats. So it has been a tremendous help to get, you know, kennels and carriers and toys and treats and litter pans and, you know, all of the beds, all of the things that, you know, that we need to try to make these cats as comfortable as possible. Our issue right now is that in the state of Florida, as long as we do not have ownership, we cannot foster these cats out.
Oh,
we cannot send them to a rescue because we don't have ownership of them. So we're really hopeful that shortly we will get news that maybe we have these cats. We're actually going through the court system to pursue gaining ownership of these cats. Quickly,
right?
Because you know, time is of the essence.
Of course, yeah.
To get these cats, you know, custody, so that we can then begin to do that. So I'm hopeful that shortly we will be able to get these cats out for adoption and out for rescue.
Okay. Well, we're just about out of time, I'm afraid, Lori. But we'll just urge people to go to the website, and especially maybe even the Facebook page for the Hillsborough County Pet Resource Center, just to kind of keep posted on that and see what else they can do. In the meantime, they can look at that Amazon list and help out in that way, it sounds like.
Absolutely, and that's tremendous help, and thank you for having us on today to talk about
that. All right, well, good luck, and we'll stay on top of this, and maybe if there's updates, we can help get those out as well.
Perfect. Thank you, Duncan.
Thank you. Coming up at 11 on WNF is Rob Lori and Radioactivity, kicking off a three-hour block of interviews, phone calls, and news, and more, including the noon hour midpoint with Nola Lalay. Then at 1 p.m., John Gilmore presides over executive session. Then the music kicks back in at 2 p.m. with Scott Elliott and the All Souls edition of It's the Music. Wrap things up. Going to hear at least a little bit of Ted Leo. I just want to quickly remind you that on Saturday, May 19th, I'll be emceeing the 11th annual Spaghetti and No Balls Dinner. Yes, you heard me. That's the Animal Coalition of Tampa, one of their big fundraisers, where they can, which allows them to do low-cost spay and neuter and other veterinarian services. That's at Yingling Brewery, May 19th, and from 6 to 9, there's a silent auction, contest prizes, raffles, giveaways, and again, it'd be great to say hello and meet you, so go to Animal Coalition's website, actampa.org, for more information. Okay, so I'm Duncan Strauss, this is Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. Let's hear a little bit of Ted Leo. I wish we could have heard more, but hope you'll, if you're not familiar with him, you'll track him down. This is one of the songs I really like among many, many on the new record, The Hangman. It's WMNF Tampa. Thanks.
Moonlight shattered on this stretch of sea. How many times I stood here mapping things out differently, but I can't go back.
Can't go back.
No, I can't go back.